Thanks, Simon. I'm Charlene. I'm an addict. It's really nice to be here. I didn't actually think I'd get here, but, and I was praying on the train. I was like, God, please get me there on time. And many a time it's been like that. I've had to do a chair and the timing, it's just like, it's not going to be possible. And I've always got there on time. It's really strange. And, you know, I just want to really acknowledge, because obviously I'm nervous, that I'm in a safe place. That's the one thing that I got when I walked into Narcotics Anonymous, that I was in a safe place. And it weren't like that. I suppose it weren't like that most of my life. I never felt safe. I was always really fearful. When I walked into the room of NA, it was the one place where I felt comfortable. I identified with people. And it was such a relief to realise that there was people like me. I'll tell you a bit about my story, where I come from. I grew up with a mother who was an addict. There was just me, my mum and my little brother. The type of life that I grew up in, my mum was a crack user, and I suppose I really resented her. I didn't like her, I didn't like the way she behaved, and I certainly didn't want to be like her. I was the kid that was locked out of the kitchen and they'd give you some chocolates and tell you go upstairs, and there'd be Rottweilers and staffs and all that, and you'd wake up and there'd be basically shit next to you, and there'd be loads of other kids and about 10 adults in the kitchen. You'd be knocking on the door and your mum would say, go away, come back in 5 minutes, babe, and all that. And I speak about that because, you know, I never thought I'd end up using drugs. And I remember a time there was a little girl and she come up and she said to me, because I weren't a stupid kid, she said, your mum's on the Evian bottle. And I was like, run downstairs, knocked on the door and screamed at my mum. And then this mum's girl come out, and the little girl got beaten up, and that's what life was like, really. I was the local kid that ran around the estate selling all the bent gear that knew all the people, and was really good at dishonesty and all that. I'd be like, yeah, it looks great on you, and basically my mum never had the privilege of finding these rooms, or any kind of rooms. Spent a lot of time in and out of mental institutions, and you know, even though my mum was the way she was, I had fears that just weren't normal, really. At school, I didn't feel part of at all. I was very nervous, but the way that I covered that up was like being a chameleon and being a clown and making people laugh. But really, I was really an angry child and had no way of communicating how I felt at all. And, you know, I just internalised everything. I picked up my first drug, though, when I was 9 years old. It was just going to the fridge, getting my mum's beers out of the fridge, and I thought, let's see what this does. And I got drunk straight away. You know, I think with drugs, what it done for me was it just killed the fear, really. I'd have a swig of this drink, and the next thing I'd be walking in the front room getting really leery to my mum. And I liked the way it made me feel, basically. The only thing I was good at school was drama, because, you know, I could escape, I could be someone that I wasn't, and I liked it. All the other classes, I'd just fall asleep in. I started puffing about 13 with my mates, and when I had to do performances in front of loads of people, I remembered how alcohol made me feel, so I started drinking there. When it got to about 15 and 16, started bunking school, putting airs in me, rollers in me hair and PVC trousers and Bette Gilroy jacket when we go down to the pub. And I weren't like me mates, because I'd have to have a bottle of vodka before I actually went in the pub, because I was scared. And I think it was, you'd get like £10 pocket money and it'd be like, get a quarter bottle of vodka, 10 fags and live off your looks. And it sounded like fun then. And my ego got me into trouble big time, because I thought it was fun being 15, going in pubs and getting older different men every weekend, and it would be like a competition. I had blackouts and all that. And I just started thinking, oh, you know, this drinking ain't really fun. And then I was introduced to speed. You know, I weren't a person that spoke on speed, really. I'd just stand there dancing. And then I remember thinking, oh, I don't like the way this makes me feel the next day. So then I found cocaine, and then I thought I'd try that. And I loved the way cocaine made me feel. I suppose it just made me feel like I was on top of the world, you know. And I weren't going to let go of that. So, you know, it was like, use it at the weekends, but if something's that good, why are you just going to use it at the weekends? I was doing A-levels, and basically the parties weren't just at the weekends, they were in the week. And I didn't want to go out of a doctor or a dentist and all that when I grew up, because of the kind of people that I looked up to. They were, well, my uncles were armed robbers or drug dealers, and I made a decision that I wanted to get out of a drug dealer, because that represented to me kind of protection because of the violence, being looked after, and power, really. So I did. I got my dreams come true. I got with a drug dealer at 17, and you know, it seemed like fun at the time because my habit was getting supplied, and I was introduced to crack cocaine, and I told him I loved him. The moment I tried crack cocaine, I thought, you know, I've come home here. Me and you are getting married. And basically, by the time I was 18, 19, my paranoia, I was about 6 stone. I was just in a room. It was like a relationship where it was just like, just me and him and the Rockweiler against the world. And it was, looking back at it now, it was scary, but I just felt so comfortable. People knocking on the doors, trying to rob you, the police being called. And our rows weren't normal. It weren't just like having an argument. He tried to shoot me with a harpoon gun. And then we'd have negotiators. And all this was just like, for a fearful person, I was creating all this madness. But at the time, I felt comfortable and it just felt normal. And it was just insane, basically. My habit got bigger, my paranoia got even worse. I weren't looking healthy. So basically, he left me for another girl, and I just felt distraught. And I thought, what am I going to do? I've got this big habit, how am I going to supply it? So by the age of 19, I turned up at the psychiatric unit, and I said to him, like, you know, you've got to help me. I'm either going to kill myself or I'm going to hurt someone else. And basically, luckily enough, there weren't no room in the psychiatric unit, so I got put into the Priory, which I thought was great at the time. I was ringing up all my mates, telling them that all these famous people were in there, and nothing changed. People come up and saw me. I weren't willing to let go of the drugs or the relationship, and they give me Librium, and all I'd done was just play ping pong all day and then sleep and then ring up my mum and try and get her to bring me Valium. And I thought that I was detoxing. I thought I was doing really well. And basically, they stopped my medication. And I don't like reality. I don't like feeling. Certainly don't like resentments. And I had all that shit, so I run out of there. And I ended up on the estate in corridors. Some guys I didn't know smoking crack. And, you know, I'd done a lot of things that, you know, I wouldn't do to a dog, to myself, to go and feed me a bit. I slept with men, I shoplifted, I stole car stereos. And a lot of horrible things happened. And basically it got to a stage where I was just in a flat with a mattress, lying on the settee, drinking cans of Stella, ringing up the crisis team. The crisis team was always in a crisis. And they'd come round, and I remember this psychiatrist come round, and he'd have this big cigar, Parianti or something his name was. And I'd just be sitting there drinking and saying, I need help and all that. And I couldn't go out no more. My friends, they'd gone a long time ago. They went when I was 17. And they put me into a psychiatric unit. I won't say I felt part of when I walked in there. I didn't feel part of them, but I knew that I didn't belong in the outside world, and I was alone. So when I walked in there, it seemed kind of fun. There was schizophrenics, manic depressants, and, you know, and I knew that I weren't right. There weren't something right with me, and basically I was in there, and I was saying to the patients, you know, you don't need that medication. You give me that and we'll go out and have a puff. And we're looking at it now. Who's the mad one? You don't put an addict in a psychiatric unit and give it medication, do you know what I mean? And that's all I'd done. I just took everyone's medication, went outside. I thought if I just drink Guinness and have a puff, I'd be all right. And because I got the patients to join in with me, they kicked me out. They said there was nothing they could do for me, that I was a chronic alcoholic and an addict. What I understand today is that I have this massive denial system, and I put up a fight, and I was like, no way, there's no way that I'm an addict. By admitting to that, it's like saying I was like all them people that I hated growing up. It was like saying I'm like my mum. It was like saying I didn't have no power in my life, and basically they kicked me out of there, and my mum was a park drinker, and because she couldn't afford crack anymore, she just turned to the alcohol. So I went and I sat with my mum and we drank in the park and took loads of Valium and DF1-8s. And looking back now, you know, they were good times for me, because I could understand her a lot more. We both had the same disease. We're both in pain, and we sat there giggling and stuff like that. I did try and sort my life out. I thought if I got a little job, everything could be all right. And I chose a hairdressing job where everyone was doing cocaine. And basically, I just ended up using on that job and doing things that were shameful and not being able to go back. And found out that my mum was going to die, that she had cirrhosis of the liver. And I was so self-centred, like, my way of thinking was all about, how am I going to use today? How am I going to get some money? Who am I going to manipulate? And I was just like, yeah, right, mum, you know, just, it didn't even comprehend to me that she would die. And she passed away in the October. And I was so consumed about thinking about using that I topped and tailed in bed with my mum after I'd been out all night and turned up at the door crying, I got no gas and electric, help me, and all that. And she's got yellow jaundice, and I didn't even think she was ill. And basically my auntie come round and attacked me, got me by the throat and was like, look at your mum, can't you see all you're interested in is them fucking drugs? And I was like, oh, fuck off. And I just run. That's all I did. If you confronted me with anything, I'd run, because I didn't like you telling me anything about me. So basically, my mum went in hospital, and I didn't go up and see my mum for... She was in there 3 weeks. I didn't go up there for 2 weeks. I was too busy sitting in my flat with people I didn't know smoking crack. And all of a sudden, I had this feeling, you better get up to the hospital. And I went up there, and... basically, it's what this disease does to you. It, you know, it's a horrible, painful death. And basically, I watched her die, and the insanity is that I saw what drugs had done to her, and all I wanted to do was use. I didn't want to sit there and be there for my little brother. I didn't want to be there holding her hand. I just wanted to use. So she passed away, carried on using. But I believe that when she died, something didn't feel right. Things just didn't feel right anymore. Because she weren't just me mum. She was me using partner. We used together. She was me mate. And when she died, it just didn't feel right anymore. I ended up alone and isolated. Got back with the boyfriend. Nothing had changed. And my story is that I just ended up in the hallway. I was always suicidal. 21 years old. Crying out for help, please help me, if there's a God out there, I can't live like this no more. And I believe that my prayers were answered, basically. It's as simple as it is. Within 2 weeks, I found the courage to ask for help. I put my hands up, I told my cousin the way I was living, what I was doing, and please help me. And I had never done that. I got into a detox, and I believe that my higher power put four wonderful angels in my way. I hadn't seen women in a long time, and I met these women that were just like me, that told me it was going to be all right, that give me a cuddle, that shared a bit of what they'd done, and I didn't feel alone anymore. And most amazing thing happened. I went to my first NA meeting, and a woman sat up there, and she spoke about things, and I thought, how can she tell these people this? But I saw that, you know, she didn't have no fear. She had respect for herself, and I knew that it was going to be all right. And I kept going back to the meetings, and I opened my mouth, and I spoke. I went to a treatment centre, and they told me that I had a disease, and that's what I believe today, and that, you know, if I want to arrest it on a daily basis, I have to go to meetings, I have to do the steps, I have to do some service, I have to have a sponsor. My problem ain't drink and drugs, it's life. Life scares me, people scare me. And Narcotics Anonymous helps me with my fear, and it's given me a lot of love. Got wonderful friends. I'm not saying that I've come into this fellowship and I haven't wanted to use, that would be a lie. I have, but the miracle is that I haven't, and that I've been carried through when I, you know, when I just can't walk, and that's why I keep coming back. So thanks.
Okay. Thanks, Charlotte.